by resisting acceptance and ownership. If there is any part of ourselves or our lives that we're not fully willing to accept, we will experience stress and friction in that area. The stress will disappear the moment we accept that part and claim ownership of it. At that moment, the disowned part of us is embraced into the wholeness of ourselves, and from that place of wholeness, miracles are born. For example, if one of your children has a drug problem, you will experience more and more stress and conflict the longer you deny ownership of the problem. If you refuse to look at the problem, your denial will produce greater stress and conflict. If you look at the problem but transfer ownership by saying, "This isn't my problem, this is my child's problem," you will experience even more stress and conflict. Resolution of the problem will begin the moment you or your child claims ownership. If you claim ownership first, full resolution won't occur until your child also claims ownership. When both of you decide to take ownership, as in, "This is my problem and I'm committed to resolving it," you can work genuine miracles. I've seen such miracles hundreds of times. Here's how to begin. Begin with time itself. Do whatever it takes to get yourself in harmony with the reality that you're the source of time. Once you're convinced, start acting as if it's true. A simple way to begin is to put yourself on a radical diet, complete abstinence from complaining about time. This courageous move will take you out of the victim position in regard to time. When you stop complaining about time, you cease perpetuating the destructive myth that time is the persecutor and you are its victim. I found this surprisingly hard when I first started the diet. Until I went on the diet, I hadn't realized how many of my conversations contained complaints about time. Notice the conversations around you this week. See how many times you hear things like, "Oh, I wish I had time to chat, but I'm in a hurry." Or, "Where did the time go?" Or, "There simply aren't enough hours in the day." Or, "If I'd only gotten another hour of sleep." Or, "I'd love to talk, but I gotta run." Or, "I have to get to the bank." Or, "I don't have time to do that right now." Each of those statements contains an overt or covert complaint, portraying the speaker as the victim of time. It treats time as a scarce commodity, sending the message that time is out there and that there isn't enough of it in here. Each statement is a mini whimper of misery, a claim that time is the whipmaster and we're its hapless galley slaves, rowing desperately to stay ahead of the lash. The moment you stop complaining about time, you free up the necessary energy to mount a similar campaign on the inner plane. You'll need that energy because it is one thing to stop complaining that you're the victim of time, but it is quite another to stop feeling that you're its victim. One particular phrase I'd like you to eliminate is this common one: "I don't have time to do that right now." Like many of us, you probably use that phrase often. Based on what you've learned here, you can probably now see that it's a total lie. It's a lie for two reasons. First, time is not something you have or don't have. You're the source of it, and you make as much of it as you want. Second, when you say, "I don't have time to do that right now," you're telling a polite lie to avoid saying, "I don't want to do that right now." By placing the blame on time, you avoid confronting the blunt truth of the matter. Imagine that you have an 8-year-old child who comes in while you're working on something and says, "Will you play catch with me?" You reply, "I don't have time to do that right now." Imagine, though, that the child comes in and says, "I just stepped on a nail and my foot is bleeding. Can you help me?" You probably wouldn't say, "I don't have time to do that right now." In actuality, you have exactly the same amount of time as when you used the excuse of lack of time to avoid playing catch. The truth of the matter is that you didn't want to play catch, and you do want to stop the bleeding. By using time as the culprit, you place yourself in the victim position once again. Of course, you did it to be polite. And by the way, I'm not advocating that you be blunt with anyone, especially 8-year-old children. I'm advocating that you stop using time or lack of time as an excuse. It's just as polite to say something to your child like, "I want to finish what I'm working on before I play catch," rather than claiming to be the victim of time. Now let's talk about an important subject, the sensation of time pressure. Notice what time pressure feels like in your body. Think of it as another sensation like hunger. We usually register hunger as gnawing, unpleasant contractions in the middle of the front of our bodies. Well, what does time pressure feel like in your body? What does being in a hurry feel like? What does the sluggish side of the time continuum, the sensation most people call boredom, feel like to you? In me, the pressure of being in a hurry feels like pressure between my spine and my heart, pushing toward the front of my chest. Your sensation might be different, or it might be similar to mine. When I tune into time pressure, I also feel neck tension and the sensation that I'm pushing slightly forward with my head. That's me if I'm in a hurry. The other end of the continuum, boredom, feels like a deadened, shadowy darkness in the front of my chest, running from my collarbone down to my navel. As I tune into those sensations right in this moment, I realize that I much prefer being in a hurry to being bored. If I had to pick one, there'd be no choice. It occurs to me that I've organized much of my life to avoid that possibility of being bored. As I tune into the being in the hurry feeling in my body, I felt the surge of another awareness. I realize it's not being in a hurry that's the real source of the feeling. It's the feeling of creative ferment happening inside me. I love the slightly chaotic inner feeling of having a bunch of interesting things to find out, of asking big questions and waiting for answers to appear, of not quite having figured out things I'm passionately interested in. That's when I feel most alive, and I like having that feeling of aliveness all the time. As a result, I can only remember one instance of being bored in the past 30 years. My instance of boredom came about because I decided to retire when I was 50. I saw myself going on leisurely beach strolls with my wife, or writing the occasional haiku, or living off book royalties, and tugging thoughtfully at the beard I always intended to grow. My wife vividly remembers my retirement, too, because she still talks about it as the longest 3 weeks of her life. I turned out to be an utter failure at retirement. Yep, I took plenty of leisurely beach strolls with Kathleen, and I think I even wrote a haiku or two. But one day in the third week of my retirement, I was out on a beach walk when an unexpected thought crept into my mind. I'm bored. It wasn't that I missed being in a hurry. I just realized that my very nature is saturated with an urge to be creating something all the time, and preferably three or four things at the same time. That's when I feel most alive. So I said farewell to retirement, and I've been happily in ferment ever since. After seeing the powerful results of my no complaints about time diet, I started inviting my clients to put themselves on it. They harvested remarkable results, too. Here are some of the benefits they told me about. One person said, "We found ourselves getting more things done without feeling rushed." Another person said, "We ended the workday feeling less fatigue." Another one said, "We suddenly had time to carry out leisurely conversations that we would have cut short in times past." One of my clients, an executive in a talent agency, gave a particularly good example of the changes he experienced. "I would compare it to changing from using my elbows to drive a car to realizing I could use my hands. Suddenly, a lot of frantic activity seemed no longer necessary. Before I took responsibility for the amount of time I had at my disposal, I felt I was in an ongoing wrestling match with time. I saw time as a big, threatening pressure that was always about to overwhelm me. When I learned the real truth, that I'm the source of both time and the pressure, it was like a huge weight lifted off me." That's exactly what it feels like. At this point, it would be traditional for me to say something like, "Take plenty of time to master these principles." However, since you are the source of time, we'll amend that to say, make plenty of time to master these principles. The original insight that we are the source of time, that time is not a pressure from outside, and that we can make as much as we need, only takes a split second to comprehend. However, it takes a lot of practice to integrate that insight into the practicality of our lives. The main thing it takes is keen attention. Be on the lookout constantly for complaints about time that come out of your mouth or go through your mind. As you spot them and eliminate them one by one, you'll grow steadily less busy while getting a great deal more done. Now, I'll step aside and let you take charge. I've told you everything I know about Einstein time, and you have everything you need to know to implement it. Let the good times roll. Solving the relationship problem, transcending the upper limits of love and appreciation. As you know by now, the essential move we all need to master is learning to handle more positive energy, success, and love. Instead of focusing on the past, we need to increase our tolerance for things going well in our lives now. If we don't learn how to do this, we suffer in every area of our lives. One area that suffers spectacularly is our relationships. As we bump into our upper limit problems, relationships are one of the key areas that suffer greatly. In fact, the greater success you achieve, the bumpier your relationships tend to be. I'll explain why and show you how to avoid this last pervasive barrier. John Cooper and Peggy Haroff conducted one of the few in-depth studies ever done on the relationships of successful people. The authors found that 80% of the 437 successful people they studied had unsatisfying marriages and long-term relationships. Only about 20% of the couples had relationships the authors call vital. The other 80% had three main styles of unsatisfying relationships. In devitalized relationships, the partners remained together in spite of having fallen out of love with each other years ago. They had been going through the motion, sometimes for decades. The relationships often looked okay from the outside, but there was little or no passion between the individuals. The second type of relationship was passive congenial. In passive congenial relationships, the partners had never been passionate about each other in the first place. Their relationship was based more on affectionate friendship. They were much like business partners. Their expectations were low, so they were seldom disappointed with each other. Because of the low expectations, they didn't fight much and so remained together in a state of ho-hum harmony. The third style is conflict habituated. In conflict habituated relationships, the partners had created a lifestyle based around constant conflict. Whether engaged in low-level bickering or heated conflict, they remained in long-term combat interrupted by periods of truce. They seemed almost to thrive on conflict, which provided them with an adrenaline-infused state of ongoing arousal. I felt a wave of despair when I first saw these findings. If these highly successful people had such dismal relationships, was there any hope for the rest of us? It's been 20 years now since I first saw this study, and with those years has come considerable experience working with people and their relationships. I don't think the overall statistics are any different now than when Cooper and Haroff first published their results. In other words, I think the majority of successful people still have dismal relationships. Now, though, I know a lot more about how they got that way. More importantly, I know a lot more about how they can avoid falling into the traps that many successful people get stuck in. I feel a great deal more hope now than I did 20 years ago. The reason is that I've seen many successful people transform their relationships, whether they were devitalized, conflict habituated, or passive congenial, into vital unions. There are two main reasons that successful people have dismal relationships. Number one, simply because they're successful, and number two, because they don't know how the upper limit problem works. The very fact of being successful makes it more likely that the relationship will be troubled because both partners have to deal with the upper limit problem to a more intense degree. Let me give you an example. I worked with a famous couple that would definitely fit the conflict habituated category. To safeguard their privacy, I'll call them Jim and Jane. Things had been going quite well in their relationship during the first 5 years, but a sudden upsurge of success tripped their upper limit switch. Suddenly they were on the covers of magazines, and ultimately they even attracted ugly badges of success such as paparazzi and stalkers. By the time they got to me, they'd been bickering and arguing for nearly 2 years straight. Recall that one of the biggest drivers of the upper limit problem is a false belief that says, I'm fundamentally flawed and don't deserve success. This false belief dominated their early lives, although neither of them recognized it until they gained an understanding of the upper limit problem. When I explained to them how the upper limit problem worked and how old beliefs spring forth to pull us back down into the old familiar negative sense of ourselves, their famous faces actually paled in recognition. Mine did, too, when it first dawned on me how much I was sabotaging my own efforts to get the love I so craved. Fortunately, I made some of those discoveries before I met Kathleen in 1980, so I didn't have to use our relationship as the laboratory for all of my early experiments. By the time I met her, I'd seen the destructive power of my own barriers to giving and receiving love. Particularly, I'd seen the power of projection, a subject that, in my opinion, should be in the curriculum of all elementary schools everywhere. A vast amount of energy can be liberated in relationships by dropping the habit of projection. As mentioned, projection occurs when you attribute to others something that's true for you inside yourself. For example, a man may complain to me that his wife is too passive. If he were to own the projection, he would say, I haven't learned yet to handle a relationship in which a woman is being powerful and equal, so I create relationships with women in which I require them to be passive. A woman might complain that her partner dominates her and limits her full expression. If she were to own the projection, she would say, I attract men who dominate and control me. I have not yet learned how to be my own boss and take up my full space in the world. Projection is the source of power struggles that eat up energy and intimacy in relationships. Power struggles are a war between two people to see whose version of reality will win out. Much of the energy in troubled relationships is drained through power struggles about who's right, who's wrong, and who's the biggest victim. Relationships, healthy ones that is, exist only between equals. When both people are not taking 100% responsibility, it's an entanglement, not a relationship. There's only one way to transform an entanglement into a relationship. Both people must drop projection and see that they are each 100% the creators of their reality. With the energy saved from banishing power struggles, much more can be co-created than the partners could have created on their own. If both people in a relationship can understand the upper limit problem, they can begin to adjust the thermostat upward so they can handle increasingly more positive energy. The thermostat can be adjusted upward in several ways. Just noticing how you limit love and positive energy solves much of the problem. Do you bring yourself down with food? Do you drink too much? Do you deflect compliments? Do you find yourself thinking of someone else while making love? Do you get sick the day of an opportunity for intimacy in the relationship? Do you hold back on communicating instead of reaching out to people? The upper limit problem is magnified in successful couples because each person is synergizing the other person's quest for a life in the zone of genius. At the same time, though, they are synergizing each other's tendency towards self-sabotage. Couples who wish to transcend these tendencies will benefit from making a mutual commitment to transcending upper limits and living with each other in the zone of genius. If both people are committed to getting there, the journey becomes much easier. In any case, it's a heroic task. The reason is twofold, because most of us have little experience observing healthy relationships, and because having healthy relationships is a new task in evolution. For the first couple of million years of human evolution, relationships were about survival, and communication was largely a matter of exchanging grunts. We're newcomers to the idea of having our relationships be about fulfillment, heartfelt communication, and deep commitment to each other. Any of us who embark on a path of conscious growth must remember that we're bringing with us millions of years of evolution. There is no quicker way to bring forth our inner Neanderthal than to get into a loving relationship. When we open up to more love and energy, we begin to flush old programming out of our system. Our energy thermostat is reset higher, and sometimes this sets off alarms in ourselves. Genuine contact with another person gets us high, and this trips the upper limit switch, making us want to come down to a more familiar level. There are several ways we limit positive energy in relationships. One is by starting arguments out of fear of intimacy at times when we could be exchanging intimacy. Another is by withholding significant communications. We get scared of being close, for example, and instead of telling the microscopic truth about it by saying something like, "My belly felt tight and my skin contracted when I heard you say," instead of doing that, we withdraw and swallow the communication. Another way we limit positive energy is by needing to control or dominate the other person, or needing to be controlled or dominated. If we always have to be right, for example, there is no room in the relationship to be happy. If you're a successful person in a close relationship, you'll likely find the following suggestions helpful. Number one, make sure you take plenty of time for yourself in a space apart from your partner. It could even be in the next room, so long as the intention is to nurture the independent part of you. Human beings have twin drives of equal power, the urge to merge and the urge to be an autonomous person. For a relationship to thrive, both drives need to be celebrated. A close relationship stirs up powerful transformative energies, and you need lots of rest time to integrate the rapid-fire stimulation that a relationship provides. If you can learn to take time off from the relationship consciously, you won't need to do it unconsciously by starting arguments and engaging in other intimacy-destroying moves. Go on solo walks, for example, or take in a movie by yourself, or spend an afternoon doing whatever the spirit moves you to do. These periods of battery charging alone time give you the ability to master longer and longer periods of closeness when you're in union with your beloved. Number two, put a priority on speaking the microscopic truth, especially about what's going on in your emotions. Get skilled at simple microscopic truths such as, "I'm sad," or "I'm scared," or "I feel angry." Communicating about feelings, dreams, desires, and other inner experiences creates deep intimacy in relationships. None of us gets any training in how to communicate about these simple things, and our lack of training is very costly. Number three, when emotions are in the air, as they often will be in close relationships, don't try to talk yourself or your partner out of them. Eliminate phrases such as, "Please don't cry," and "There's nothing to be angry about." Feelings are to be felt, so encourage each other to go through complete cycles of emotions. If you're sad, let yourself feel that way until you don't feel sad anymore. Same thing with fear, anger, happiness, and other feelings. It's the act of stifling and concealing feelings that causes problems in relationships. Number four, give yourself and your partner plenty of non-sexual touch. Sexual touch is great, but human beings need non-sexual touch in large quantities. A loving hand squeeze or a touch on the shoulder communicates love and caring in ways that no words can. Number five, after soaring to a new height of intense intimacy, bring yourself back to ground in a positive way. Many people, when they enjoy a time of deep closeness, unconsciously create an argument or an accident to get their feet back on the ground. It's not necessary to use a painful method of grounding yourself. It works much better and is much more fun to come back to earth by doing some earthy dancing or taking a walk on the surface of the earth or cleaning out a closet full of your earthly possessions. Number six, cultivate at least three friends with whom you can form a no upper limits conspiracy. The word conspiracy comes from two Latin roots that together mean to breathe together. That's the kind of conspiracy I want you to create. I want you to feel the power of two or more people in harmony, working toward a benign goal that's good for everybody. You and the other members of your conspiracy will educate each other on the upper limit problem. You'll spot each other running upper limits behaviors such as worrying, getting sick, having accidents, and so forth. You and your conspiracy will gently remind each other that you create the quality of your life experience out of your beliefs. You'll remind each other to examine those beliefs to make sure they're giving you room for ultimate success in love and life. When you trip and fall, as we all tend to do from time to time, you and your co-conspirators will remind each other to take a deep breath, center yourselves, and open up again to feeling more love, abundance, and success than you've ever before enjoyed. If you're a successful person in relationship with another successful person, you've embarked on one of the great quests in all human endeavor. For me, it's the ultimate thrill ride, a journey in which every moment is packed with learning potential and the opportunity to experience true joy. With the ideas and tools we've explored, you have everything you need to set sail and navigate the tricky swirls and currents of intimate relationships. The rest is practice. No matter how brilliant we might be at making money or making music or making soup, we are all amateurs when it comes to feeling and expressing love. Personally, I like it that way because it gives every moment of life an exhilarating learning edge. It keeps me cheerfully humble to think of myself as a beginner in a field in which I'm acclaimed as an expert. I also know from painful experience that the moment my attitude of cheerful humility slips into self-righteousness or arrogance, the universe will just as cheerfully step in with an unexpected way to make me humble again. The universe will teach us our lessons with the tickle of a feather or the whomp of a sledgehammer, depending on how open we are to learning the particular lesson. Getting stubborn and defensive invites the sledgehammer. Getting open and curious invites the feather. It took me a long time to figure out who was in charge of the painfulness of my lessons. To prevent humiliating collisions with the universe, I suggest we all adopt an attitude of being open to learning in every moment of our relationships. Every interaction contains within it the possibility of deep connection with our beloved, with ourselves, and with the cosmos. Relationship is the ultimate spiritual path, because it constantly presents us with the challenge to love and embrace in the very situations in which we're most prone to shun and reject. For that reason above all, relationship is the place where our spirituality most visibly comes to light. You can tell more about a person's true spirituality from the way he or she treats his or her partner than you ever could from tallying that person's church attendance. The key to spiritual development through relationship is being open to learning from every moment of interaction. By doing so, we welcome the ups and downs of relationship instead of resisting them. We approach each moment with an open mind and a willing heart. This attitude cuts down on friction, enhances the possibility of deep connection, and keeps us from being battered when our turbulence occurs. In that spirit, let me close our discussion of successful people and relationship with a translation I made of a poem by the 14th century mystic Hafiz. It's called Your Divine Invitation. You're invited to meet the divine. Nobody can resist an invitation like that. Now, your choices narrow to two. You can come to the divine ready to dance, or be carried on a stretcher to the divine emergency room. And now let me say a few concluding words. As you move toward greater success, love, abundance, and creativity in your life, you'll encounter the upper limit problem. I say it is the only problem you really need to solve. The problem, though challenging, brings a priceless gift hidden within it. The gift reveals itself as you explore and solve the problem. The gift is a special kind of relationship, a living connection with the source of genius within you. The upper limit problem is our universal human tendency to sabotage ourselves when we have exceeded the artificial upper limit we have placed on ourselves. The upper limit problem is caused by a too low thermostat setting on our ability to achieve and enjoy our ultimate success. The thermostat gets set low early in our lives at a time when we could not think for ourselves. Later, as we dream about big goals and move up into realms of love, abundance, and creativity that are above our old thermostat setting, we bump up against the artificial lid that was placed on our success through unconscious childhood decisions. Unless we solve the upper limit problem, we'll keep finding ways to bring ourselves back down when we've blown past our old setting. The childhood decisions all were made unconsciously as we navigated through difficult family cross-currents. Those unconscious decisions become barriers we must overcome in order to express and enjoy our full measure of success. There are four of these barriers. The first barrier is a false belief that we are fundamentally flawed in some way. If we carry this feeling within us, we sabotage our success because we think we're essentially bad. If something good happens, we must mess up to offset it, because good things can't happen to bad people. The second barrier is the false belief that by succeeding, we are being disloyal to and leaving behind people in our past. If we harbor this feeling within us, we sabotage our success because we think it's disloyal to our roots to soar too far into the stratosphere. The third barrier is the false belief that we're a burden in the world. If we carry this feeling inside us, we sabotage our success so that we won't be an even bigger burden. The fourth barrier is the false belief that we must dim the bright lights of our brilliance so that we won't outshine someone in our past. If we hold this feeling inside us, we tend to hold ourselves back from expressing the full potential of our innate genius. Understanding why we've limited ourselves liberates a new energy in us, which we can then draw on to propel us to new heights of abundance, love, and creativity. As we spiral upward in our quest to express our unique genius, we'll likely soar past ghosts and shadows of those old barriers. For this reason, it's best to think of our quest as a continuing journey of transcending upper limits. The payoff for the work is a gift of enduring value. We get to live in the full rainbow of our potential, in our zone of genius. In that exalted space, we enjoy the love, abundance, and success we create, and our very presence inspires people wherever we go in the world. We transcend our upper limit problem each time we make more room inside us to feel more love, abundance, and success. It's done moment by moment, and the moment goes like this. We catch ourselves worrying or starting an argument. Suddenly we realize we're upper limiting. We let go of the train of worry thoughts or the huffy point of view, taking a deep breath or two for relaxation. Perhaps we wiggle our toes or stretch our shoulders in a gesture of opening up space to feel more love, success, and abundance. A moment later, we break free of the upper limit and feel a flow of good feeling again. In wink-of-an-eye moments such as these, we expand our capacity to enjoy more love, abundance, and success. These moments are the springboards of our big leap. It may not happen in our first moment or our 101st, but if we practice with diligence and zeal, one magic day we'll look up and realize we have created our beautiful life in the zone of genius. On that day, we'll look around us and see other friendly faces in their zone of genius. We'll look at each other and say, "Welcome, friend." On that day, we'll know that heaven and earth are truly one. As we come to the end of our time together, I want to tell you how grateful I am to be sharing these ideas and processes with you. They are sacred treasures to me, and I feel blessed to have been entrusted with them. I feel doubly blessed for a lifetime of teaching them to others. The experience of learning these things has gifted me with a life of more magnificence than I ever knew existed. and passing them along to you has allowed me to fulfill my life's grandest purpose. For that great privilege, I thank you from the top, middle, and bottom of my heart. As my work on this project was drawing to a close, I went out into the backyard to stretch my legs and get some fresh air. It was approaching dusk, and the blossoms of evening were just beginning to breathe their fragrance into the air. I sat for a few minutes in our swing, enjoying the soft breezes, the sweet air, and the sounds of my neighborhood. I could see Kathleen in the living room, deep in communion with a novel by one of her favorite mystery writers. I could feel a warm, glad-to-be-home sensation within me, and as I expanded my attention to let myself enjoy it thoroughly, waves of bliss spread through me. Suddenly my mind chimed in with a philosophical observation. This won't last forever, but it's wonderful while it's happening. I realized with a chuckle that this commentary, whether wise or trite, was really a subtle upper-limit behavior. I had obviously exceeded my tolerance for backyard bliss. My old philosopher persona had shuffled in from the shadows to bring me back to earth. So I gave the old fellow a loving pat on the back and sent him back to his quiet corner. Then I turned my attention back to where it belongs, feeling the blissful richness of this fine moment. Here's my wish for you, a life journey blessed with many such moments of discovery. Going forward on your path, may your every day be filled with much practical magic and many everyday miracles. May you transcend each and every one of your upper limits, and long may you glide the high currents of love, abundance, and creative contribution. I'd like to take a moment now to acknowledge people who were essential in bringing all these ideas to the light. First, I'm deeply grateful to my beloved mate of the past 3 decades, Kathleen Hendricks, for being with me in every exploration that inspired this material. With every passing year, I grow more in awe of the loving kindness and astute brilliance she radiates. Living in the field of her love is the greatest honor and privilege any person could want. As I say to her nearly every day, you make me feel like the luckiest man on earth. People of the present and future, I say to you, study this woman. She is the real deal. I thank the members of my creative, quirky, and loving family. Amanda, Chris and Helen, Elsie, Imogen, you are on my mind and in my heart every day. I also want to bow to the memory of my mother, Norma Hendricks, my grandparents, Rebecca Dell Garrett Kennedy and Elmer Ray Kennedy, and my aunts, Lindell, Catherine, and Audrey. Also, I'm very grateful to have a literary agent, Bonnie Solo, who is much more than a major professional asset to my life. She's a treasured friend and confidant, dearly loved by both Kathleen and myself. I'm also blessed with a staff who make it possible for me to accomplish a great deal more than I could ever do on my own. My gratitude to you all is boundless. Baby steps and big leaps, my early adventures as an entrepreneur. When I give talks to business audiences such as the Young President's Organization, I notice that the entrepreneurs in the audience often show the most enthusiasm for my ideas. I feel a natural resonance with entrepreneurs, partly because I've been having entrepreneurial adventures since I was a kid. I've also found that entrepreneurs are often most receptive to one of my core beliefs, which is that business is ultimately a spiritual path. I've found that business and every other aspect of life goes much better if I stay in touch with the spiritual aspect of myself. There's a good reason for this. If I make a split between money and spirituality, as I did for part of my life, I can't harness the most awesome power we have, which is our spiritual essence. If we can heal that split and realize that money is simply spiritual energy in motion, we can put the power of spirit to work for us in creating wealth with ease and flow. I had a personal experience early in my life that left an enduring impression on me. It was the first spiritual experience I can really remember clearly, and it happened when I was 5 years old, the summer before I was in elementary school. I was playing by myself in the side yard on a hot summer day in Florida. I had just come home from spending a morning in a children's program at my family's church. The program featured stories of Jesus, art projects involving Jesus, and songs of the Jesus Loves Me variety. There was a great emphasis on Jesus' role as the Son of God. As I was playing outside, I was thinking about the Son of God part of the story. What did this mean exactly? I'd never known a living father because he had died during my mother's pregnancy with me. So I didn't have any felt sense of what it might feel like to actually have a father. Suddenly I found myself wondering if I too was a son of God. It seemed that if Jesus could be a son of God, maybe I could be one too. This thought sent a thrill through me, a wave of exhilarating feeling I can remember as vividly as if it happened a minute ago. I looked up through the branches of the trees into the blue sky shimmering in the tropical air. Is that where my father lives, I wondered? Is that where I came from? Then a special kind of awareness settled into me, a sure knowledge that seemed so obvious I wondered why I hadn't thought of it before. The thought was this: I am made of the same stuff as everything else. The trees, the sky, the earth beneath me, we're all made of the same thing, and it is all one thing. Everything is connected to everything else. I am the Son of God, and everyone else is too. It has to be that way because everything is connected and everything is equal. I remember lying on my back looking up through the trees for a long time. A feeling of deep peace and contentment settled into me. The feeling continued for hours even after I tried to describe my experience at dinner and got a few blank stares of the "What the heck are you talking about?" variety. Somehow, it didn't matter whether people understood, though, because I knew what I felt, and I felt what I knew. Later in life, I came across a stunning passage from the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, which spoke to me directly across time from first century Rome. Here's what he said: "I am part of the whole, all of which is governed by nature. I am intimately related to all of the parts, which are of the same kind as myself. If I remember these two things, I cannot be discontented with anything that arises out of the whole, because I am connected to the whole." Well, a Roman emperor would seem to have little in common with a kid in a sleepy southern town. Somehow, though, the same awareness showed up in both of us. Why and how could that be? After wondering about these questions for many years, I've now become convinced that we eventually become aware of our unity with the whole because it's inescapable. The awareness is wired into us because we're wired into the universe. We can try with all our might to pretend we're separate from the rest of the universe, but one way or the other, it will catch up to us and welcome us back into its embrace. It must have been around that time that I hatched my first entrepreneurial venture. It was an utter failure, at least in the traditional sense, because I didn't attract a single customer. However, it foretold with uncanny accuracy my ultimate career and also illustrated several of the key spiritual principles I've drawn on ever since. You've heard of outside-the-box thinking? Well, my first business was literally inside the box. With my granddad's help, I cut a door in the side of a large cardboard box, which I installed in a corner of my grandparents' living room. This became my office. Above the door was the word "problems," which I hand-lettered in red, assisted in spelling by granddad. I commuted to work on my tricycle, parked it next to the box, and clambered inside to work with my clients. I had a tough time explaining to my family the exact nature of the business I was in. I made it clear to the family that I did not handle medical problems. They could go to a regular doctor for that sort of thing. I explained as best I could that I handled problems you didn't take to a regular doctor, like how to get along better with other people. I was in the people-fixing business, with the stated goal of helping people be happy. To appreciate the unlikelihood of my chosen job, you should know that I grew up in a small town in Florida that had no psychiatrists or psychologists or any other kind of mental health professional. It's a mystery to me where I might have gotten the idea to become a problems doctor. Although my family of lovable lunatics certainly could have used my services, none of them ever climbed into the box with me. I was forced to work with imaginary patients whom I cured of everything from general misery to specific ailments. The only specific ailment I can remember at the moment is that I cured one imaginary patient of the tendency to bark like a dog. My family found all this endlessly amusing and were still telling stories about it well into my adulthood. By the way, if you're thinking I've got a great memory, I don't. However, I was blessed with a journalist for a mother. Mom wrote a column every day for the local paper, and my adventures often served as material for her column. Thankfully, she clipped and saved hundreds of her columns, which have proven to be worth gold in refreshing my memory of my childhood enthusiasms. The ultimate joy of being an entrepreneur is creating something that people find valuable, particularly if it's something that hasn't existed before. My cardboard box counseling center was not valued by the customers, but nothing like it had ever existed before, at least in the part of the world I lived in. To this day, few things give me more satisfaction than inventing something that hasn't existed before. Many of my inventions have been total failures in the financial sense, while others have gone on to make millions of dollars. In the larger sense, all of them have been winners because they held the fascination of creating something from nothing. Let me tell you about my brief career in the egg business. I hatched an egg business when I was in the second grade. It was my second entrepreneurial attempt, and it ended in a disaster reminiscent of Humpty Dumpty. My mother financed some chickens for me. The plan was that I would pay her back through the sale of the eggs, hand-delivered to neighbors, then go on to reap vast profits in the egg business. Well, I underestimated the amount of daily work it took to feed and maintain my chickens. But other than that, the plan began to pay off. My chickens began to lay eggs, and all went well for the first few deliveries. One day I was rushing to make a delivery when I tripped climbing the steps of Mr. and Mrs. Geiger's house. I landed on top of the dozen eggs I was carrying, wiping out my profits for the entire week. Not long after that, I faced another disaster. My chickens escaped, causing me to spend a hot afternoon rounding them up from the neighborhood. Unbeknownst to me, during their break for liberation, some of the chickens had feasted on camphor berries from a neighbor's tree. My next batch of eggs tasted and smelled like Vicks VapoRub. The end of my egg career was near. My mother began having second thoughts about the egg business. She was under pressure from the neighbors who didn't like the racket the chickens made in the backyard. Finally, she shut my operation down with very little complaint from me, and we donated the chickens to a farmer we knew. I looked for other business opportunities and soon spotted an opportunity that had all the ingredients of a winning enterprise. I would soon learn, though, something quite contrary to an old saying. When life gives you lemons, do not make lemonade. When I was 9 years old, I launched a lemonade stand, which quickly taught me the truth of that old saying, location is everything. I moved it to 4 different corners of my block before finding the one with the most foot traffic. I also learned a few other key truths on my first day of business. 1. Flies love lemonade. 2. Ice melts fast in Central Florida. 3. You have to stand around shooing flies a long time in order to sell a pitcher of lemonade. According to the family story, though, there was another problem. I drank up a lot of my profits. I've conveniently forgotten this part of the story, but I suspect there may be some truth in it. If you stand around a pitcher of cold lemonade for long enough on a hot day, you're going to want to take a swig. After a few days in the lemonade business, I decided to fold the enterprise and seek my fortune somewhere else. Finally, though, I found a business that worked and made my first dollar as a professional entrepreneur. The difference between an amateur and a professional is very simple, $1. The moment you make a buck of keeping money from your entrepreneurial efforts, you're a professional. And I attained professional status when I was 10 years old. It was the summer after 5th grade when I conceived my first successful business. I also learned something incredibly useful for any business enterprise. Think from the customer's point of view. My next-door neighbor, Mr. Lewin, was in the watermelon and Christmas tree business. An odd combination, you might think, but not for a guy who liked to spend half the year in Florida and half the year in Long Island. When he was in Florida for the winter, he shipped watermelons northward. While he was in Long Island for the summer, he made deals that would ship the trees south to Florida the next winter. I admired Sam Lewin for lots of things. First of all, he was a source of great stories. having walked across Russia to escape Cossacks. He settled in Germany only to encounter more intolerant types there. I loved talking to a man who had dealt with real-life Cossacks and Nazis, who spoke Yiddish, German, and Russian, and who could talk into two telephones at one time. Mr. Lewin would put one phone down in his lap, fire off a burst of Yiddish into the other phone, then switch back to English on the first phone. By hanging around Mr. Lewin, I collected a great arsenal of Yiddish words and phrases I used when I wanted to hurl innovative insults at my friends. If I remember correctly, ganef, which means thief, and shlemiel, which is a habitual screw-up, were a couple of my favorite epithets. In my neighborhood, there were copious opportunities to use both these terms. I came up with the idea of selling watermelons by the side of the highway that ran through my hometown. This was long before Interstate 95, the big freeway that now runs through Florida. In my day, southbound motorists had to percolate through the many small towns on Highway 27. Each town had its own speed trap, and rumor had it that my little town made much of its annual budget from nabbing northerners speeding toward Miami. For a watermelon entrepreneur, this was a dream come true. My watermelon location had a stream of hot drivers poking along at the local speed limit of 25 miles an hour. Mr. Lewin fronted me four watermelons to sell, and I agreed to split the profits with him. In those days, whole watermelons sold for about 25 cents. Mr. Lewin, bless his heart, let me have the melons for the super wholesale price of a dime per melon. I remember having to make four trips down to the highway to lug the huge melons down to my stand. My first day in the business, I stood all day in the Florida sun holding my watermelons 25 cents sign, and I didn't sell a single melon. Boy, was I discouraged, especially when I had to haul the melons one at a time back up the hill to Mr. Lewin's garage. That night, though, I had a revelation. People weren't buying because they couldn't see the immediate benefit of biting into a juicy, crisp slice of melon. Then I had an inspiration. What if I sliced the melons into eight pieces and sold the slices for a nickel apiece? The next day I tried my new approach, and my melon business went wild. Hot motorists responded gratefully to the sight of a juicy slice of watermelon being held aloft. Dads and moms would practically jump from their cars to get slices for their screaming backseat passengers. I sold my 32 pieces in about an hour and went back up the hill many times for more melons. I had the weather on my side, too. The day was excruciatingly hot, just perfect for watermelon sales. When I closed down for the day, I had $3.75 worth of nickels, which I carried home in a bag and carefully spread out on the floor to count. Nowadays, $3.75 will barely get you a medium cappuccino, but in 1955 it seemed like a small fortune. Even though I've had a lot of success since then with my entrepreneurial activities, I can tell you that nothing has ever quite equaled the pure joy of seeing all those nickels spread out on the floor. There was also a satisfaction that day that went far beyond the financial. It was seeing the delight on the faces of all those people as they bit into a cool, sweet watermelon on a hot summer day. It's one thing to give customers what they want, but to see them devour it on the spot is sweet satisfaction indeed. When I went back to school that year, I'd put close to $50 in my savings account. I think those early ventures still guide my thinking. They taught me to focus on what I now think of as priority number one, creating things that make people's lives better. I also do my best to create things that make their faces light up, just like biting into a watermelon on a hot day. By focusing on those qualities, I wake up each day knowing I'm going to spend my time creating value and delight. I've lived in that state of consciousness for decades now. It's what I love and what I wish for you. The best job of all is doing something that doesn't feel like a job at all.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.